Okay, it's Stephen Dubner. Is that Governor Raimondo?
It is. Hi, Stephen. It's Gina. How are you?
Hi, Gina. Very nice to meet you. Thanks so much for doing this.
Yes, I'm happy to. I'm a secret closet economist.
You are 46 years old, and you've done a lot. You have an undergrad econ degree from Harvard, a PhD in sociology from Oxford, as a Rhodes Scholar, a JD from Yale, and then 10 years in venture capital focused on healthcare, and then general treasurer of Rhode Island before your election as governor in 2014. So I have to say, when I think of Rhode Island, I think of the tiny state next to Massachusetts, a state whose most famous resident is probably Peter Griffin from the animated comedy Family Guy, who's a dumpster fire of a man.
Oh, geez, Lois, I just spent all morning on a boat with my friends drinking beer, telling jokes, and screwing around. How about a little me time?
I think of a state.
Imagine a place that
whose
feels
tourism
like
ad campaign accidentally featured restaurants from Massachusetts and a scene shot in Iceland.
But just 10 seconds in, it takes us to a shot 2,500 miles away.
I think of a state that I rarely hear about in discussions of forward-thinking technology or economics or society. I think of a sort of a land that time forgot. So a state that's had one of the highest unemployment rates in the U.S., one of the highest rates of death from opioid abuse, one of the highest rates of unfunded or underfunded pension liability. And then when it comes to politics, I think of, this is just me, I think of former Providence Mayor Buddy Cianci, one of the most corrupt mayors in modern American history. So that's what I think of when I think of Rhode Island, kind of knee-jerk. I'm guessing that's not what you think of when you think of Rhode Island. So give me your version.
So, you know, those are the lowlights, I guess, but I can give you the highlights. You know, when I think of Rhode Island, I think of some of the best beaches in America. I think of Brown University and RISD and Johnson and Wales. We are nestled between New York and Boston, which means if you want to start a company and be part of the ecosystem of Northeast talent, but you can't afford the eye-popping prices of New York and Boston, you should come to Rhode Island. And having said that, we were stuck. You know, it was kind of a tragedy. There's no reason that a state with our resources and strategic location should have had the highest unemployment rate in the country for as long as we did. But today, our unemployment rate's below the national average. In the past year and a half, companies like GE Digital and Johnson & Johnson and, you know, 17 other companies have moved here. So my experience is it's an amazing state. People just don't know about us. And when I tell a story, people fall in love. They just don't know the story.
Today on Freakonomics Radio, we will hear the story of the Rhode Island recovery as told by its unconventionally Democratic governor, Gina Raimondo. We'll hear how the old story went.
We had a model, which I often refer to as train and pray.
We'll hear some of Raimondo's plot twists.
My tagline at the time was, "This is math, not politics."
And some surprise endings.
One of the places I got that idea was from the Republican governor of Tennessee, Bill Haslam.
We'll get to all that right after this.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Why did you want to be governor of Rhode Island?
Because in order to help create jobs in the state, you have to be the governor. I had been state treasurer and spent 4 years working really hard to fix our broken pension system. But I realized what Rhode Island really needed was more jobs, a better economy. We were stuck.
Gina Raimondo had personal experience with this economic stuckness. She grew up in Smithfield, Rhode Island, in a tight-knit Italian-American family. Her grandfather had immigrated at age 14, and he learned English in the public library. Her father, a World War II veteran, worked for 26 years at a Bulova watch factory. But when the factory moved overseas, her family took a big financial hit. Later came more sad news. In order to fix its broken budget, Rhode Island was cutting funding for the libraries where her grandfather learned English. One big cause of the budget trouble? A $7 billion shortfall in pension funding. So Rhode Island was in pretty terrible shape with unfunded or underfunded pensions, pension liability. You undertook pension reform back when you were treasurer, before you became governor, and this involved raising the retirement age and cutting cost of living adjustments, which are the things that people talk about but rarely do. I know this made you extremely popular among unions and retiree groups. How did you get it done, and talk about how effective it has been? I know that there was a suit and that there was a settlement where the state did pay some money to those retired groups.
Yeah. So it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy to do, not something that you ever really want to do, but I felt it had to happen because we had one of the worst, if not the worst, funded systems in America.
You were below 50%, I believe. Yes.
We were. Yeah, we were. You know, pensions weren't going to be there for people when they needed them. And at the time I was doing this, we had a small city in Rhode Island, Central Falls, go bankrupt.
Live from Eyewitness
News. In large part because of unfunded pension liabilities.
Rhode Island's poorest and smallest city, Central Falls, is now the state's first and only city ever to file for bankruptcy.
I've been telling my firefighters and police that we need concessions for the past 6 years. That we needed concessions, we need concessions, we need concessions.
Central Falls is the canary in the coal mine of Rhode Island.
When they went bankrupt, they cut the pensions in half of already retired people. And I have to say, it broke my heart to see, like, you know, 70, 75-year-old firefighters saying, I can't buy my food, I can't buy my medicine, I can't stay in my house, I can't live on $14,000 a year. So I decided I'm not doing that. You know, it's not about my politics. It's about shoring up this system, because the reality is our system would have been fine for like 5 years, maybe 10 years. But there's a lot of people in the system who need their pension to be there in 30 years or, you know, and it wasn't going to be. So anyway, my tagline at the time was, this is math, not politics. I went around, I talked to anybody who would listen, including many people who did not want to hear from me. And I basically said, look, I got some bad news. This is the math of it. I know we need to solve this.
So when Central Falls went bankrupt, I don't mean to sound cynical here, but politicians do talk about never letting a good crisis go to waste. Was it the kind of crisis that got the attention of voters and others in the state and then let you say, look, if we want to have it not be that bad, we have to at least take some medicine now?
I think it lent credibility to what I was saying. It was hard for people to say, oh, she's fear-mongering, or she's not right, this won't happen, because it was happening. So it just made it very real at the time. I don't want to sugarcoat this. There was a huge amount of resistance. Many people did not agree. However, the legislature overwhelmingly voted for my proposal. So it was vast majorities, bipartisan, voting in favor of the proposal.
And then you did, we should say, get elected in a statewide election to governor. This move was made as treasurer, correct?
Yes, yes. No, you're right. You're right. It made for a very difficult election. I had a very difficult Democratic primary running for governor, you know, frankly, as a result of this. But I won.
So how do you explain that you did something that would be theoretically so politically unpopular, especially for a Democrat, and yet you then won governorship as a Democrat?
I think it was the right thing to do, and people realized that. You know, I told the truth to people. I was honest. I was sincere. And we solved the problem. You know, we did solve the problem.
So what is the state of pension funding in Rhode Island today? I realize it's a marathon, not a sprint, but where are you at and how's it looking?
It's looking quite good. It's improving its funding level. But just as important, we also have money in our budget to invest. So since I've been governor, we've had the money to triple the number of public pre-K classrooms in Rhode Island. We've brought about all-day public kindergarten for every kid in Rhode Island. We are for the first time in a long time, fixing our roads and rebuilding our bridges. So, yeah, we took the medicine, as you said, but now we're investing like crazy. And again, we were in the dumps. We had the highest unemployment in America years after everyone else had come out of the recession. And now the wind's at our back. Our job growth in certain sectors like advanced manufacturing is the highest in New England. When I look out my window from the State House, I see three cranes in the sky. The investments are paying off.
The investments Raimondo's talking about sometimes come in the form of business subsidies, the kind of incentives offered to lure big out-of-state companies to set up shop and create local jobs. This practice has plenty of detractors, including Raimondo's predecessor as governor, Lincoln Chafee.
I've never liked corporate welfare because it's unfair to the existing businesses. That's what I've always felt. The ones that have been here for years, loyally paying their property taxes and their sewer taxes and their water taxes, and then all of a sudden some outside company comes in and give them the candy store, I just don't like it. I don't think it's fair. We're seeing that money go out the door to General Electric, to Johnson & Johnson, billion-dollar companies.
We know that governments offering tax breaks and other incentives does work to draw firms and therefore employment. Of course, there's a cost to that, too. Talk to me about what you've done, maybe in addition to the tax breaks and incentive, but especially beyond that in drawing these firms and increasing employment.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty small piece of the puzzle. I mean, those are the things that grab the headlines because they are big, big brand name companies. But most of the reason that we have had this economic comeback in the past couple of years is because we're investing in our people. We have job training programs, which I've completely retooled since becoming governor, that are working. We've created tight partnerships between our high schools and our companies. I've started the first, some people say the first ever, but maybe the first in a long time, small business loan fund that's run out of the Rhode Island Commerce Corporation. And these are like micro loans, you know, somewhere between $5,000 and $100,000. And it's pretty amazing how well it's working. I was with a round table of a couple dozen businesses yesterday, and their stories were all the same. Like, we are a small business in Rhode Island. We're too small for the bank to lend to us. We got turned down by a bank. We came to you, and the money you gave us allowed us to go to a trade show. We got a new client. We tripled our business. One woman who owns a great restaurant now, she's like, I needed a few thousand dollars to move an oil tank from the basement. I couldn't do my business without that.
So one constant friction between governments and business is that a lot of businesses complain that governments are mostly a hindrance, whether it's with regulations or obligations. You know, small businesses will say, we don't necessarily need you to do something for us, just stop doing things to us.
Yeah. When you're getting a business going, you're like paying the bills on your credit card and you're trying to find a place to set up shop. It is very annoying if you have to take time out of work to go to City Hall to stand in line to get a permit. If you have to call to get some kind of permit or license or whatever and call back four times and hang online for half an hour every time. Like, that's real. And so since I've been governor, I've eliminated a ton of regulations. We're moving to put all our permitting systems online. Having said all of that, government does help, right? Like these job training programs I just told you about, these companies need it and we are providing it. And we just made, I'm proud of the fact that we just became the fourth state in America to make community college tuition free.
What kind of residency requirement is there afterwards? If I get a free community college degree from you and then I move immediately to Massachusetts or California, do I have to pay you back?
We ask them to make a pledge that they'll stick around for a couple years. So yes, the deal is you have to go full time because we want people to graduate. You have to keep up a minimum grade point average. Can't get into trouble. Got to be in academic good standing. And we want you to live in Rhode Island for at least 2 years after you graduate.
Tell me how many students either are taking advantage or you expect to take advantage of this free community college, and then I want to know what it costs the state and where the money comes from?
We know that this year, on account of the scholarship, the first-time full-time students is up 43% over last year. So 43% more kids this year than last year, and 1,500 enrolled with this scholarship. By the way, an interesting fact, Hispanic enrollment of Latinos, is up 70%. African American enrollment up 52%.
I guess is, among other things, a really good indicator that cost was a huge barrier for certain groups, right?
That's exactly what I was, cost is the reason. You know, in America, 4 out of 10 kids drop out of college, and cost is the number one determinant. People make life-determining decisions, often over a very small amount of money. Like the SAT, I'll give you a perfect example. One of my initiatives is, this year, we're putting the SAT during school, not on a Saturday, and we're making it free for everybody. The number, it's just like skyrocketing how many people are taking it. And I sit with kids, and I'm like, why didn't you take it before? This will change your life. Like, where am I going to get the $80, Governor? Where do you want me to get it? This is another thing that motivated me with the Promise Program. Kids drop out every day over $400. I'm like, really? Honestly, you dropped out of college over $400? It might as well be $40,000 because they don't know where to get it. Let me tell you how we're paying for it. It's less than $4 million a year. It's like $3.5 million a year. By the way, our total budget is $9 billion. And where are we getting it? We are prioritizing. It's coming out of our budget. I found the money in a balanced budget. It's not that much money.
$3.5 million for 1,500 kids, though, that sounds like super cheap tuition.
Well, do you know why, though? The way we've structured this, it's what they call a last dollar scholarship. So in order to get the scholarship, you have to apply for all federal aid you're available for, like Pell Grants, for example. You have to apply for any kind of other scholarships. And then there's often a gap, you know, like $1,000. So the average size of our scholarship is not huge. You know, it's $1,000, $2,000 because they get their Pell money. We've seen a huge increase in the Pell recipients because now that people know they have a shot at going to college, they're more likely to apply for Pell and they're not leaving that money on the table.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, why have Democratic governors become an endangered species?
The Republican Party and Republican Governors Association and Republican donors have just done a better job focusing on states.
But governors, we're told, can't afford to be as partisan as the politicians in Washington.
It's real. You know, the camaraderie is real.
We will be right back.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Gina Raimondo is a business-friendly politician who took on labor unions to push pension reform. And yet, she's a Democrat. In other ways, she's more typically Democratic. Her views on the Republicans' federal tax reform, for instance. We spoke about it before things were finalized, but the gist was pretty clear.
So whenever I look at any policy on a federal level, the question I always say is this good for Rhode Island? And I can say unambiguously, the versions of the tax bills that I've seen are bad for Rhode Island. We don't have that many multi-millionaires who this is geared towards. And rich people don't need a tax break, period. I think the wealthiest Americans should be paying higher taxes at a federal level.
What would you like to see that rate? Do you want it like Scandinavian level?
I don't know. I do think carried interest should be taxed like ordinary income. We need money to invest in our roads, in higher education, in like the Promise Program we just talked about, the community college program. The federal government ought to be doing that. It's just a giveaway to the wealthiest Americans, and they don't need it.
I'm always curious. You're a governor, which, you know, there's only 50 of you in the country. And when we citizens hear about this proposed legislation at the federal level, I think we always assume, or I guess I like to assume, that you governors are like, you're on the bat phone. You have the red line. You're hearing stuff from the federal government. Like, this is where it's at. In other words, I assume that there's this massively awesome pipeline of information. Sounds like you know about what the rest of us know about the proposed tax plan.
Absolutely. There's no such bat phone. I wish there were. Like, Rhode Island, thank goodness, we have terrific U.S. senators. They both opposed repeal of the Affordable Care Act. I don't even know if they're in the room. They can't get the information.
This doesn't sound like the way federalism is supposed to work, does it?
I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. And it hasn't always. I mean, this is a new phenomenon. Talk to people who've been in the Senate for a long time, and they'll tell you, yes, it's always been nasty, it's always been partisan, but we used to have hearings and work groups and actually pass laws and actually get the work of the people done.
We often hear about the fraternity of governors across the U.S. and that party affiliation matters a lot less among governors than among other high-level politicians, I guess naturally, because, you know, they don't really affect your state and your fate so much. Can you talk just for a moment about that fraternity of governors?
It's real. You know, the camaraderie is real. I'll give you a great example. Back to the community college program. One of the places I got that idea was from the Republican governor of Tennessee, Bill Haslam. And I spent a lot of time talking to Bill because he did the same program a couple of years ago. And we tweaked their proposal based on lessons learned. He actually did a public conference call with members of the media and the chambers of commerce in Rhode Island for me to help me pitch the program. I've spent a lot of time talking to Republican governors about pension reform. You know, hey, Gina, how'd you get that done? So it's real, it's helpful, it's productive.
It's also encouraging to those of us who aren't in government and who kind of think of government as maybe even more dysfunctional than it is. Do you think that given that sort of relationship between governors from different states who are in different parties, do you think maybe we, the public, the media, whatever, should pay more attention to state-level politics and the governors? Because really, if you think about it, all the oxygen gets sucked out of the room looking at the stuff at the federal level. And honestly, my argument, the argument of this show for years has been that an awful lot of legislation that happens at the federal level doesn't really affect people in their daily lives so much, whereas at the state level, it truly does. Do you think we kind of have our eye on the wrong capitals sometime?
Absolutely. I think that all the time for so many reasons. I mean, first of all, I think, as you say, people would be heartened by it. Like my neighbor to the north, Charlie Baker, governor of Massachusetts, Republican. He and I work on stuff all the time. We're together tackling the opioid overdose problem. We're working together on renewable energy because we want to do a renewable energy procurement. And I may join our state into like a regional procurement. So when you talk about energy policy or public health crisis, you want us collaborating. But here's the other thing, which is something that I think very few people realize. We're all very focused on the fact that Republicans dominate Washington. Most people don't know that right now there's only 15 Democratic governors in America. That's unusually low. And there's a lot of us on the ballot next year. I don't think that's good for democracy to have such an imbalance of power from the White House all the way down. I think there's a story there. And folks ought to cover it instead of just covering inside the Beltway.
Well, one story that an economist might tell or another social scientist is that, wow, people, voters are really expressing their preferences and they're really voting for across the board, not just on the national level, but on a state level. You know, 35 out of 50 times they're saying, oh, yeah, we kind of like that party position more. What makes you an unapologetic Democrat looking at those numbers as opposed to saying, oh, man, our party really isn't doing a very good job either coming up with the right ideas or communicating those ideas?
Well, that could be part of it, by the way. I'm not saying that that isn't a part of it. But I also think, if I'm very honest about it, the Republican Party and Republican Governors Association and Republican donors have just done a better job focusing on states. You know, so guys like the Koch brothers just decided many years ago they cared about state legislatures, they cared about governors' mansions, and they've tactically invested, and it's working, frankly. Like, it's working.
Indeed, in 2016, the Republican Governors Association raised more than twice as much money as the Democratic Governors Association, and Koch Industries was the Republicans' largest donor with just over $2 million. And they don't appear among the top 20 contributors to the Democrats. Blue Cross Blue Shield, meanwhile, was number one on the Democrats' list and number two on the Republicans, with just under $2 million in each case, giving slightly more to the Republicans.
Well, the other thing, you know, governors control, in most states, redistricting lines. So if your goal is domination of your party, you're smart to focus on governors. Like, it's not by accident that we may never have another Democratic governor of Texas. You know, the lines are drawn by governors such that that state is firmly in control of Republicans.
So we talk a lot on this show about the rise in evidence-based medicine and evidence-based education and so on. So I know you studied econ as an undergrad and then were a venture capitalist for years. And those are two realms that certainly thrive on evidence, numerical or otherwise. So to what degree would you say that the evidence-based movement is gaining even a little bit of momentum within national and particularly state-level politics? Can you talk about that?
It is gaining momentum, but I will say it's not the way most of government is run. When I took office, I knew that I wanted to really focus on job training, education, apprenticeships. I would talk to guys in the building trades who had been out of work for years, losing their houses, losing their marriages. So I said, we have to completely turn upside down the way we do workforce development. We had a model, which I often refer to as train and pray. Train people and pray they get a job. And it turns out that's not effective. And we actually called a team up at the Harvey Kennedy School to come down here and spend a lot of time putting in place a way that we could really measure the outcome of our job training. And I have to say, it's pretty awesome. We have hundreds and hundreds of employers deeply engaged in the program. We've gotten well over 1,000 people good jobs, but we get rid of programs that don't work. You know, like you say, okay, this program working with the maritime industry, I'm just using examples, is great. You know, everybody's gotten a job. This other program over here working with the IT industry, not working so well. The results aren't there. Maybe we ought to shut it down and go to another thing. And so for me, I'm a believer in it because it's got to work.
Some of the things you're mentioning now about employment, especially the apprenticeships and especially the state working within industries, that sounds practically European. I mean, the German model, which has proven incredibly successful at staving off recession and unemployment. What's been your inspiration for these kind of ideas?
That in part, by the way, I was a little bit late running over here today because I had a dozen people in my office who were engaged in the apprenticeship model in Rhode Island, and we spent a lot of time talking about the German model. I'm a big believer in pushing the limits of apprenticeship, not just for traditional, you know, plumbing, pipe fitting, welding, but what we're doing in Rhode Island around apprenticeship is cybersecurity technicians, community nurses, public health people, IT employees, computer techs. The days of going to high school and getting a decent job are sadly behind us. So we got to retool. And apprenticeship models can be very effective to get folks high-end skills, advanced skills, to get a decent job and keep a decent job.
In terms of preparing the populace for the work, you know, the labor scenario that's coming down the road, I know you've been pushing to have every student in Rhode Island take computer programming classes. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's happening now or that's still in progress. Is that a thing already?
It's happening now. We set a goal, I think a year or so ago, that by the end of this year, we would be teaching computer science in every district, in every grade, starting in kindergarten, and we're going to hit that goal this year.
So I hear about this kind of thinking a lot, and I certainly understand the appeal and the resonance, but I do also wonder if there's a proven upside of having everyone learn computer science or programming. It strikes me a little bit like the equivalent of having, you know, every student in America during the boom of the internal combustion engine learn to take apart a carburetor. And then I think, you know, if you look at the history of economics and progress, that one of the main strengths of economic progress is the division of labor and specialization rather than everybody chasing after the latest trend. So I'm curious what the evidence was that inspired that move of yours.
I think of it as access and exposure. And also just providing people with a basic level of essential skills. So everyone has to take math. They may become a writer. They may become an actor. But they ought to have a certain basic level of math skills. First of all, because it's an essential skill to function. And by the way, they might like math. I think digital skills are the same thing. No matter what job you have to have some basic familiarity with computer skills and digital skills. And so it is as essential in this economy as any other skill that we teach. But also, we know, and there's loads of data on this, girls, people of color, and low-income folks are less likely to go into IT fields, which tend to be higher paying. However, if they're exposed to some computer training, they're much more likely to go into the field and do well at it.
Yeah, that was an excellent answer to my churlish question, I have to say.
No.
So if you're not careful and you keep having these kind of successes as a pro-business Democrat who took on, you know, unions for pensions and things like that, someone's going to want you to run for president, plainly. Are you interested?
No, I do want to get reelected next year as governor of Rhode Island.
But you can do that first, correct?
Yeah. Well, I think I'm in the fourth inning of an economic turnaround in Rhode Island, and I want to get it done. And then who knows what comes after that.
So you're a relatively anomalous Democratic governor in that you've got a business background in venture capital and so on, and in bringing along small businesses. Do you think that that is the sort of component that's necessary for modern Democrats to get elected?
I don't know if you have to have come from business, but you have to understand value and respect businesses and small business in particular, and understand the fact that really what most people crave and deserve is a decent job with economic security. So in other words, if you're afraid to talk about business or to appear too close to business, it's hard to actually tap into people's real and legitimate anxiety about the economy. Because folks just want a job. That's what I want for my kids. What do you want? I don't know if you have kids, but like, what do you want for your kids? You want them to be happy and have a steady job.
Yeah, you know, I want my kids to be layabouts. I want to work so hard and so well during my career that I just give them the checkbook when I die and say, go
okay,
for it.
Okay, well, I'm in public service, so there's nothing left to bequeath.
Oh, yeah, great. Good point. Good point.
So they're on their own.
All right, I should let
you
go.
All right, I gotta go. Thank you, Steve.
It's been a great pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. Coming up next on Freakonomics Radio, as our conversation with Governor Raimondo showed, a lot of pieces of our political system need improvement. So let's start with this. If you could pick one political idea to kill off, what would it be?
I want to kill the idea of one person, one vote.
A closed primary.
The idea I want to kill is that we're spending too much money in politics.
It's coming up right after this.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio with your host, Stephen Dubner.
You know, I had been fighting to try to bring up issues that I thought were important to address, and basically the Senate had been shut down.
That's Olympia Snow from Maine.
Yes, I served in the state legislature in both the state House and the state Senate prior to my 34 years in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate, where I served 16 years in the U.S. House of Representatives and 18 years in the United States Senate.
Over that time, the tenor of Congress changed a great deal.
In fact, the last Congress I served in 2012, it was the least productive Congress in modern history.
Snow was a moderate Republican, a coalition builder, happy to work across the aisle. In fact, her support for some Democratic positions on reproductive rights, on ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell, her votes for Democratic judicial nominees, this all came to anger her Republican colleagues, especially the new breed of hardliners. Over time, Snow saw her brand of centrism essentially disappear.
And in fact, three political scientists conducted a study and said that we are experiencing the worst polarization since the end of Reconstruction, 1879. If you think about it, that is, you know, pretty serious. An analysis up through 2013 that showed 1982, there were 58 senators that came between the most conservative Democrats and the most liberal Republicans. At least up until 2013, and I doubt that that has changed, for the fourth time in a row, fifth time ever, zero senators come into that category. In the House of Representatives in 1982, there were 344 members of the House of Representatives that came between the most conservative Democrats and the most liberal Republicans. So it tells you, you know, there is no Democrat who is more conservative than a Republican. There's no Republicans more liberal than a Democrat.
This polarization became spectacularly manifest during the debt crises of 2011 and 2013, when Congress threatened to shut down the federal government. It actually did so in 2013 and again briefly at the beginning of this year.
I mean, I was stunned that we would be at a point in the United States Congress that we were prepared to take the country to the financial and political brink to make a political point.
Snow had been planning to run for re-election to the Senate. Everything was in place. She was just 65 years old. She had the money and the organization. In her previous election, she'd won nearly 75% of the vote. But she decided that she didn't fit in this Congress anymore.
And so they abandoned legislating and policymaking, and it just devolved into a series of, you know, gotcha votes, my way or the highway, and the all-or-nothing proposition that was really the road to nowhere. And I decided that I would take my fight on the outside because I realized that the change was not going to occur from within.
Snow joined the Bipartisan Policy Center, which addresses, as she calls it, congressional dysfunction and political paralysis. She wrote a book called Fighting for Common Ground, How We Can Fix the Stalemate in Congress. Many of her solutions have to do with recreating a bipartisan Congress, less filibustering and grandstanding, more regular meetings between majority and minority leadership, more regular meetings between Congress and the president, because that's how it was in Snow's early years in Washington. But over time, moderates were purged from both parties and partisan battles became more intense, more destructive. So, what's to be done about that? In this segment, we ask politicians and scholars, donkeys and elephants and everybody in between, what is the one political or electoral practice that deserves to die? Olympia Snow has a long list of things she would change. Among her proposed solutions, getting rid of gerrymandering through independent nonpartisan districting, limiting the power of political action committees, and requiring a 5-day work week in Congress, which would, as she writes, provide additional time to address the critical issues while also fostering more opportunities for senators and representatives to interact socially with each other in Washington. But if there's one idea that Snow would personally like to kill off, it would be
a closed primary.
Meaning a nominating contest that is closed to voters who aren't registered with a particular party.
Today, there are very few what you would call centrist, moderate candidates on either side of the political aisle. And that's the problem. You no longer have the middle in politics. There is the middle in America, but they're not producing the candidates because the primaries are so close that it gets locked down. And so it's only those who are the hardline activists that are ultimately voting in the primaries and therefore voting those who are more aligned to their views that are not predisposed to building compromise or consensus, that are nominated, and therefore that is the choice for many in the general election. And the bigger fear today among elected officials is facing a primary, because that's where you get the more hardline ideologues who are going to be participating, as well as the outside groups that weigh in with millions of dollars and that will work to defeat these candidates. So that is the problem.
Open primaries already exist in 15 states, while a few more, including California, have what's called a top two primary. That lets voters choose any candidate they want in a single open primary, and then the two top vote getters advance to the general election, even if they're both from the same party. So far, political scientists are split on whether open primaries really help. Some research shows that moderate candidates don't do any better in an open primary. Others argue the change in California has already led to more competitive elections and a more functional state legislature.
We need to change the way we currently vote.
That's Howard Dean.
My title is former governor, former chairman of the DNC, former presidential candidate.
The DNC, for those who don't know, is the Democratic National Committee.
If I could do a single thing in American politics, it would be to get rid of the single vote for your favorite candidate. Right now, we vote for one person, and that person either wins or doesn't win. That is, if there's 10 candidates in a race, you get one vote. There's a system called ranked choice voting where you don't get just your vote for the top choice that you have. You also get to vote on all the other choices, and you get to rank them. So that if your candidate doesn't win, your second choice vote counts. What that does is create, as the winner, the person who is best respected and best liked overall in the electorate. It's just a good system. The other thing about it is that it makes people behave themselves better. San Francisco put in ranked choice voting a few years ago, and they had the most polite mayor's campaign that you ever saw, because if you're hoping to get somebody's second or third choice vote, if you know they're not going to get their first, you're not going to say anything bad about them in the campaign, because you drive those voters away, and those are the voters that eventually get you elected.
A lot of the people we talked to for this episode had similar-ish ideas about modernizing or at least adding some nuance to our current electoral habits. Rob Ritchie, for instance, of the electoral reform group called Fair Vote.
I'd like to get rid of winner-take-all elections to elect Congress, state legislatures, and city councils. So whoever gets 51% of the vote represents 100% of people. If you get 60% of the vote, you not only represent 100% of people, but no one even cares about the election because you're going to win easily. And we're left with elections that leave most people stuck in sort of lopsided one-party districts. The proposal that we put out there, there's something called the Fair Representation Act as a draft, and we have some members of Congress who do want to put it in. What it does is a statutory change that within states, they would take congressional elections, go from having only one person per area to bigger areas with more than one person. So a state like Massachusetts might go from 9 one-winner districts to 3 3-member districts, and then in each district, it would take about a third of the vote to win a seat. That degree of opening up the system does some really interesting things. One, it makes the general election matter, and it very methodically and reliably represents the left, center, and right of every district.
If there's one thing that I could do differently in our democracy, it would be doing away with straight ticket voting.
And that is Joaquin Castro, a Democratic congressman from Texas.
Straight ticket voting means that you can go into a ballot booth and without looking at any of the individual candidates or races on the ballot, at the top of the ballot, you can simply mark that you want to vote for all the Democrats or all the Republicans. And what it's done is it's allowed a lot of people to go into the ballot booth really on autopilot without considering the specific candidates in a particular race. So if I could retire straight ticket voting, I would.
Norman Ornstein is resident scholar at a conservative think tank called the American Enterprise Institute. He, too, is troubled by the overt partisanship in politics.
So I've become a big proponent of the Australian system of mandatory attendance at the polls. In Australia, and this is a system that they've used for 8 decades or so now, you don't have to vote, but you do have to show up at the polls or write a plausible excuse. If you don't show up and if you don't write the excuse, you're subject to a small fine. In my various trips to Australia and my discussions with politicians of all political stripes there, they will tell you that when you know that your base is going to be turning out to the polls, and when the other side's base you know is going to be turning out to the polls, your focus turns to the persuadable voters in the middle, and it changes the way you talk about politics. You don't talk in the most strident and extreme terms in ways that are designed to gin up your base or to scare them to death. You don't work on wedge issues, things like abortion or transgender bathroom issues. Instead, you talk about the issues that matter most to the broad range of voters, and especially those persuadable ones, the big ticket items, and you're forced into talking in ways that look at the issues so that you can persuade people.
I think you'd agree we've already heard some pretty interesting ideas, but none of them is particularly radical. Okay, so how about this one? It's an idea called quadratic voting.
My name is Eric Posner, and I'm a professor of law at the University of Chicago.
And what's the idea Professor Posner would like to kill?
And I want to kill the idea of one person, one vote. So in place of our current system, what I'd like to see is a system in which people would have lots of votes. Imagine, for example, that you're given a kind of a currency, let's say 100 credits. And every time there's an election, you could allocate those credits among different candidates in different races.
In other words, you could use credits to buy votes.
So, for example, if you really cared about somebody, you could buy lots of votes for that person. And if you cared only a little bit about another person, you could buy just a few votes for that person. And then there's a final element in this scheme, which is a little more complicated but also important, which is that when you use your currency to buy votes, you pay the square of the number of votes that you cast for a particular person.
The square of the number, meaning you multiply it by itself, to square, from the Latin quadrum, which is why this idea is called quadratic voting.
So, for example, in the mayoral race, I might care a lot and pay 25 credits to buy 5 votes or 81 credits to buy 9 votes until I have no credits left. So now I have a way of registering how intensely I feel about a candidate. Now, here's why this could matter. As people have known for thousands of years, democracy is prone to various problems like tyranny of the majority. And one interpretation of tyranny of the majority is that a majority of people who don't really care about a particular outcome or a particular candidate, let's say, but nonetheless favors that candidate, could outvote a large minority of people who passionately care. And most people think that that's not a good outcome, that we want people who passionately care about an outcome to have more influence on it. Of course, they could be outvoted if the majority is huge, but you do want to give them the chance to register the intensity of their preferences.
If quadratic voting isn't radical enough for you, consider this idea.
The idea I want to kill is that we're spending too much money in politics.
Pardon me? You mean we're not spending too much money in politics?
Each year, automobile companies spend roughly $25 billion on advertising.
In contrast, 6 years ago,
all candidates for the House, Senate, and the presidency spent $7 billion, roughly 30% of what auto companies spend each year.
That's Bruce Ackerman, a Yale law professor.
The problem isn't that candidates are spending too much money letting us know where they stand. It's that the rich are dominating the conversation. To change this picture, the citizens of Seattle have come up with a fundamental reform. At a referendum, they endorsed a program that will provide each registered voter with a democracy voucher to spend in support of whoever they favor for candidates for municipal office. One person, one vote, one voucher. This is the formula for reclaiming democracy in the United States. Suppose, for example, that we took the Seattle idea national. Under my proposal, federal legislation would provide every registered voter a special credit card account containing 50 democracy dollars during presidential years and lesser amounts during off-year elections, funded by tax revenue. Account holders could send their democracy dollars to a government website that would credit the money to their favored candidates and political organizations. About 130 million Americans went to the polls in 2012. If they all spent their democracy dollars, they would have injected about $6.5 billion into the campaign, dramatically changing the balance of economic power in politics.
Ackerman has written a book about this idea with his Yale Law colleague Ian Ayers. It's called Voting with Dollars.
Only one point needs emphasizing here. The voucher program is perfectly constitutional under current Supreme Court doctrine. There is no need to wait for a constitutional amendment or a dramatic change from the Roberts Court. All we need is a serious political movement to push the Seattle idea forward. This is a reform whose time is coming.
So the democracy dollar idea wouldn't need constitutional amendment, but what if it did? What happens when a good modern idea is stymied by an antique document?
I think that one of the significant weaknesses in American democracy is the difficulty of amending the U.S. Constitution.
Sandy Levinson teaches constitutional law at the University of Texas at Austin.
In fact, the United States Constitution is, among world constitutions, probably the single one that's most difficult to amend.
Our Constitution is also generally thought of as the longest surviving operational national constitution in the world, which may be something to be proud of, but as Levinson suggests, it may lead to a lack of flexibility.
I think it is a serious blemish on our democracy that we venerate the Constitution, we celebrate it, but often very thoughtlessly, and we prefer to attack each other and to attack the deficiencies of certain alleged leaders or political parties rather than to confront the possibility that it's the 1787 Constitution itself, in its surprisingly unamended form, that is afflicting our politics.
The idea that I would like to die unmourned, buried as quickly as possible, no funeral, is the notion that we have to have a live, cheering, jeering audience at presidential debates.
Kathleen Hall Jamison directs the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania.
The reason I want to get rid of that idea and I want to get rid of that concept as quickly as possible is that we know that the audience response in the auditorium to the debate content affects the audience at home, and as a result can bias not only what people learn, but their evaluation of the candidates.
In 1988, for instance, when Democratic vice presidential candidate Lloyd Benson debated Republican VP candidate Dan Quayle.
I have as much experience in the Congress as Jack Kennedy did when he sought the presidency.
Senator Benson.
Senator, I served with Jack Kennedy. I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
That's highly problematic. That audience can include partisans whose jeering and cheering is choreographed. There's no reason to think that audience is representative. Has a whole lot of donors in it, among other things, and that's problematic because we shouldn't have donors as the primary in-studio audience for a presidential debate. And also, it's problematic because when you have a jeering, cheering audience, the candidates have to respond by increasing their volume in response to each other. And when you edit those responses by the candidates into sound bites, they can sound unhinged. That's not fair to the candidates. So unfair to the audience, unfair to the candidates, unfair to the process.
Coming up next time on Freakonomics Radio, we continue killing off bad political ideas. Among the people we'll hear from, longtime GOP advisor and strategist Karl Rove.
I'm just saying, if you think it's bad today, it was worse before.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. If you just can't wait until then, check out our podcast. You can get it on Apple Podcasts or any podcast app, or at Freakonomics.com. Talk to you later.